Welcome back, everyone, to Cyber Mornings Daily. It is really fantastic to have you joining us again.
Great to be here.
For anyone just tuning in, this is where we really get stuck into the most compelling cybersecurity stories, the latest research, all the insights, and, well, we go on a deep dive.
That's right.
We're definitely not just skimming the headlines today. Oh, no. We are plunging into three truly captivating narratives from the digital world.
And each one's packed with twists, turns.
Exactly. And some utterly crucial lessons. Think of it like your express lane to being, you know, exceptionally well-informed.
With a few surprises thrown in, maybe a bit of humor.
Hopefully. Enough to keep you absolutely hooked.
Yeah.
Today, you're going to hear tales that really span the digital landscape.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking record-breaking digital tsunamis crashing onto critical internet infrastructure.
Yeah, that first one is quite something.
Then there are surprising breaches of trust involving, well, our most beloved entertainment brands and their youngest audiences.
A very different kind of threat, but just as important.
And then, get this, an audacious digital bank heist that honestly sounds like it's straight out of a movie.
It really does.
So get ready for those aha moments, because we're delivering practical takeaways, things that will not only broaden your understanding, but maybe sharpen your own digital defenses too.
And what's particularly striking, I think, about the incidents we're digging into today is how, well, despite seeming pretty different on the surface,
right,
they're actually deeply interconnected. They sort of illuminate different facets of the digital threats we all face, often without even realizing it.
That's a great point.
So our mission for this deep dive is exactly that, to move beyond just what happened, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, the headlines.
Exactly, and truly get into the how and, really importantly, the why behind these events.
Okay.
We want to equip you with that comprehensive understanding, blending those essential technical details with the very real human and business impact.
Making you truly well-informed.
That's the goal. Let's peel back the layers.
And what a place to begin peeling back those layers. Okay, imagine this, if you will. A digital tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
Not water, obviously, but an absolutely gargantuan wave of pure data just crashing down with incredible force onto a company.
Right.
And this wasn't just a ripple. It peaked at an astonishing 11.5 terabits per second.
Wow.
Just try to wrap your head around that figure for a moment. It's immense.
It really is hard to visualize that much data.
This record-setting volumetric distributed denial of service, or DDS, attack, well, it was autonomously detected and mitigated by Cloudflare just recently.
Autonomously, that's key.
Yeah, and to really grasp the scale, 11.5 terabits per second, that's a mind-boggling amount of data, even if it only raged for about, what, 35 seconds?
Still, 35 seconds at that volume is incredible pressure.
It was a UDP flood, primarily originating from Google Cloud, apparently.
Yeah.
And Cloudflare noted their defenses were, and I quote, working overtime to block it completely autonomously.
That speed of response is crucial.
It's fast, incredibly fast, and really a sign of the escalating sophistication we're seeing out there.
Absolutely. And maybe we should zoom out a bit just to clarify what a volumetric DDoS attack really is.
Good idea.
At its core, it's basically an attempt to overwhelm a target with just a massive surge of traffic.
All right.
Think of it like, I don't know, thousands, maybe even millions of people all trying to squeeze through one tiny doorway at the exact same time.
Right. Total gridlock.
Exactly. The goal is pretty straightforward. Flood the network bandwidth, exhaust the server resources, and ultimately just make it impossible for legitimate users to access the services.
So everything just grinds to a halt.
Pretty much. What unfolds behind the scenes is this cascade of issues.
Mm.
You get network congestion, severe packet loss, significant service disruptions.
Okay.
And under that kind of intense pressure, the targeted servers will slow right down, become totally unresponsive, or sometimes even crash entirely.
And you mentioned it was a UDP flood. Why is that significant?
Ah, right. UDP. That's the user datagram protocol. Now, unlike TCP, which most people might be more familiar with.
The handshake one.
Exactly. The transmission control protocol. TCP needs that handshake to set up a reliable connection before sending data. UDP, though, it's connectionless.
Meaning?
meaning there's no preliminary back and forth to establish a session, no confirmation that the other side even received the packet. And attackers just love UDP for this reason. They can blast out an enormous volume of packets incredibly fast without needing to check if the target's getting them or if they're getting lost.
It's just brute force.
Pure, unadulterated, digital brute force. It's like turning a fire hose directly onto the target, just overwhelming it with raw, unrequested data. Makes it exceedingly difficult for any legitimate traffic to squeeze through.
Got it. So where does all this traffic come from?
Well, these kinds of attacks are typically launched from these vast networks of compromised devices. We call them botnets.
Right. I've heard that term.
And these aren't just powerful servers anymore, which used to be the case. Increasingly, they're made up of everyday IoT devices.
Like what?
Oh, everything. Personal computers, sure, corporate servers sometimes, but also smart home gadgets, security cameras, smart thermostats, those digital video recorders, DVRs, even, you know, smart refrigerators.
Seriously? My fridge?
Potentially, yes.
Yeah.
These devices get secretly infected with malware, and then they're controlled remotely by threat actors.
Who orchestrate them all together.
Exactly, to send traffic simultaneously, creating that digital tsunami we talked about.
Wow.
And the trend we're seeing is particularly alarming. These hypervolumetric DDoS attacks, that means attacks exceeding, say, 1 billion packets per second or 1 terabit per second.
Okay.
They've seen an absolutely exponential rise. Just look at the numbers. They jumped from around 700 in the first quarter of 2025 to a staggering 6,500 in the second quarter.
That's a huge jump.
It's massive. And that wasn't even the only big one recently. Just back in May of this year, we saw another significant attack peaking at 7.3 terabits per second.
So this 11.5 TBPS one is the new record. But it's part of a trend.
Precisely. The scale and the frequency are just escalating at an incredible pace.
So these attacks are obviously designed to disrupt services, cause chaos.
Primarily, yes.
But what's truly remarkable here, and maybe a bit terrifying, is that a volumetric DDoS isn't always just about bringing down a website or a service.
No, that's often not the whole story.
It can be far more than just an inconvenience, right? It's often used as a sophisticated smokescreen tactic.
Exactly. That's a really important concept.
Attackers use this overwhelming flood of traffic, all this noise and chaos, as a massive attention-grabbing distraction.
Right. Everyone's focused on the fire.
Exactly.
Yeah.
While the security teams are scrambling, you know, working diligently to mitigate this visible flood that's triggering all sorts of alerts and alarms.
All hands on deck for the DDoS.
Other often far more insidious multi-vector attacks can be quietly launched in the background, completely unnoticed.
Sneaking in the back door while everyone's watching the front.
It's like a classic magician's trick, isn't it? Your eyes are fixated on the flashy misdirection, the big dramatic show.
While the real work is happening elsewhere.
While the real nefarious work is happening quietly, unobserved, behind the scenes.
Yeah.
The hidden agenda for these smokescreen attacks is to let threat actors basically sneak through network defenses.
And do what?
Steal sensitive data, transfer funds illegally, access high-value accounts, or cause further deeper exploitation within the network. It's a truly ingenious and, frankly, terrifying strategy.
It really is. And this leads us nicely to understanding the anatomy of the botnets that actually orchestrate these attacks.
Okay.
Let's take Rapperbot, for example. The name, ironically, sounds almost playful, doesn't it?
Rapperbot, yeah. Hardly sounds threatening.
But its capabilities are anything but playful. Rapperbot specifically targets network video recorders, or NVRs.
NVRs, those are the boxes for security cameras.
Exactly. Those often forgotten devices that manage your home or business security cameras. And it also goes after other Internet of Things, IoT gadgets.
Why NVRs specifically?
Well, NVRs are a particularly juicy target because they're frequently installed, connected to the internet, and then, honestly, rarely touched or updated again.
Set it and forget it, unfortunately.
Pretty much. They often run on older, less secure, and more vulnerable firmware. That makes them low-hanging fruit for attackers who are looking to quickly expand their botnets without having to deal with active patching or, you know, sophisticated defenses.
Makes sense.
And this really highlights a systemic vulnerability in how we deploy all these smart devices, both personally and in businesses. They're often overlooked in our security posture.
So how does Rapperbot actually get in the initial breach?
Right. The initial breach involves this multi-step process that showcases a high degree of attacker ingenuity, actually.
Okay.
First, the threat actors actively scan the internet, just searching for security flaws in NVRs to gain that initial access.
Looking for unlocked doors.
Essentially, yes. One specific vulnerability they exploited was a path traversal flaw in the NVR's web server.
Path traversal.
Yeah.
What's that in simple terms?
Okay, think of it like this. A path traversal vulnerability lets an attacker access files and directories that are stored outside of the folder they're supposed to be in, the web root folder.
Oh, okay. Going where they shouldn't.
Exactly. Imagine a poorly configured door that, instead of just letting you into the living room, also lets you into the attic, the basement, maybe even the neighbor's house through some connected, unsecured passages.
Gotcha.
In this specific case, it allowed them to leak valid administrator credentials.
Oh, wow. The keys to the kingdom.
Pretty much. Once they have those credentials, they push what looks like a legitimate firmware update. But it's fake.
A Trojan horse update.
Precisely. And this fake update isn't just benign. It executes a set of carefully crafted bash commands.
Okay, and what do those commands do?
This is where it gets quite clever. These commands mount a remote network file system, or NFS.
NFS. Like yeah. Network sharing.
Exactly. A way to access files over a network. Specifically, they mount it from the IP address, 104.194.9.127. And the purpose is to run the actual WrapperBot binary, the malware itself, directly from that shared file system.
Hmm. Why go through the trouble of using NFS? Why not just install the malware directly?
That's a great question. And one naturally wonders, why NFS? Well, the security researcher who analyzed this noted something important. NVR firmware is often extremely limited.
Ah.
You can't just install or execute any old software directly on many of these devices. So mounting NFS is actually a very astute choice. It bypasses those limitations.
So they found a workaround for the device's restrictions.
Exactly. It means the attackers had to thoroughly research specific brands and models, designing an exploit that could function within those extremely limited conditions where direct software installation just wasn't feasible.
That shows some serious dedication.
It's a testament to their persistence and their, frankly, deep understanding of the corps of these specific devices.
Okay, so the malware is running via NFS. How does it get its instructions?
Yeah.
The command and control.
Right, the C2 infrastructure. It needs that to receive commands. And WrapperBot doesn't rely on just a single, easily traceable IP address that would be too easy to block.
Makes sense.
Instead, it dynamically retrieves the actual list of C2 server IP addresses from DNS TXT records.
DNS TXT records, like hidden in the domain name system?
Sort of. TXT records can store arbitrary text data associated with a domain. So the malware looks up these records for specific hard-coded domains like iranistrash.libri and pool.rentcheapcars.sbs.
Okay.
And the IP addresses it finds in those TXT records are then mapped to a fully qualified domain name, or FQDN, which is generated by a simplified domain generation algorithm, a DGA.
DGA.
Hey.
That sounds complex. What does that do?
It's a brilliant strategic trick, really. A DGA is basically a piece of code within the malware that allows it to dynamically generate a constantly changing list of potential command and control server domain names.
So this one server gets taken down.
Exactly. If defenders find and block one C2 server domain, the botnet can simply call home to the next generated domain name on the list.
Making it much harder to stop.
Far more resilient, much harder to track, and incredibly difficult to completely neutralize.
Wow. Okay.
And these generated FQDNs are then resolved using DNS servers that are hard-coded within the malware itself, bypassing local network DNS settings if necessary.
Clover.
WrapperBot then establishes an encrypted connection to the C2 domain that has that valid DNS TXT record description. And from there, it receives its commands, typically launch DDS attack against this target.
And does it try to spread itself too?
Oh, yes. The malware is also designed to propagate. It actively scans the internet for open ports on other vulnerable devices to further spread the infection and grow the botnet army.
It's like a virus spreading.
In a way, yes. A self-propagating digital weapon.
And here's a crucial detail, something that really speaks volumes about the current state of IoT security. The researchers noted that for WrapperBot, get this, no persistence is actually needed.
No persistence, meaning it doesn't even try to stay installed.
Exactly. They continue.
Yeah.
They just scan and infect again and again because vulnerable devices continue to be exposed and are easier to find than ever before.
Wow. So they don't even care if the device reboots and wipes the malware.
Apparently not. Their methodology is chillingly simple. Constantly scan the internet for old, unpatched edge devices, DVRs, routers, NVRs. Brute force them or exploit known flaws. Make them execute the botnet malware. Rinse and repeat.
The sheer volume of vulnerable devices makes persistence unnecessary.
Precisely. If a device reboots and the malware is gone, they'll just reinfect it again later when it pops up in their next scan. It's kind of depressing, actually.
It highlights a massive ongoing problem.
So let's really put this into perspective for you, listening at home or in the office. Even if you're not running a major web infrastructure company like Cloudflare, the rise of these hypervolumetric attacks and these incredibly sophisticated botnets like RapperBot, well, it impacts absolutely everyone.
Mm-hmm. It's not just a big company problem.
Not at all. Think about the hidden dangers lurking in plain sight. Your smart fridge, maybe? Your home security camera? That old router tucked away in the corner of your living room?
Yeah.
Any of these could be unknowingly recruited into the next massive DDoS attack. Or, even worse, serving as that smokescreen for something far more sinister targeting someone else.
Your device becomes part of the weapon.
Exactly. Mm. And this RapperBot story, it goes beyond just the usual advice of patch your devices, though that's still critical, obviously.
Of course.
It really reveals a fundamental flaw in the whole IoT ecosystem. The built-in obsolescence of security.
What do you mean by that?
Well, manufacturers often prioritize getting products out fast, keeping costs low, and long-term security updates often fall by the wayside.
Right. They stop patching after a year or two.
Or sometimes never even start. They're essentially creating devices with a ticking security time bomb built in. Attackers exploit this predictable neglect. They know there's this perpetual unpatched attack surface out there.
So the real insight here
is recognizing that securing our digital lives requires more than just individual vigilance. We need a systemic shift in how IoT devices are designed, supported, and maybe even regulated throughout their entire lifespan.
Demanding more from the manufacturers.
We absolutely need to demand more from the devices we bring into our homes and businesses. Okay, let's shift gears completely now.
Right.
Moving from massive digital floods to a very different kind of digital battleground, one that hits even closer to home, especially for families.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about children's online privacy. Now, we often focus on big tech companies battling sophisticated hackers.
Mm-hmm. That's the usual narrative.
But sometimes the issues emerge from really unexpected places, like with our most beloved entertainment brands.
Interesting. Who are we talking about?
We're talking about Disney, a company synonymous with childhood magic, you know.
Of course.
They are now set to pay $10 million to settle claims from the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, the FTC.
$10 million? What for?
The core of the issue. Mislabeling videos intended for children on YouTube.
Mislabeling? How?
Which inadvertently allowed the collection of kids' personal information without explicit parental consent.
Ah, that sounds like a COPI violation.
Exactly. This isn't just some minor oversight. It's a significant breach of trust for parents and really a crucial lesson in digital responsibility for everyone.
It really is. And placing this in a wider context, this entire situation revolves around that critical piece of legislation you just mentioned, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Rule, or COPIA.
Right. Can you remind us what COPIA does?
Sure. This rule, it was actually enacted way back in 1998.
Wow, that long ago.
Yeah. It's incredibly important because it specifically requires websites, online services, and apps to do two key things before collecting personal information from children under 13.
Okay. What are they?
First, they have to notify parents clearly. Second, they have to obtain verifiable parental consent.
So parents have to know and agree.
Precisely. And this isn't some obscure new regulation either. You might remember Google and YouTube themselves previously paid a staggering $170 million back in 2019.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. That was huge.
It was to settle their own COPPA violations. And that's exactly why, since 2019, content creators on YouTube have been explicitly required to mark uploaded videos and even entire channels as made for kids or MFK.
Okay, the MFK tag. I've seen that.
And the whole purpose of this MFK designation is paramount. It instructs YouTube systems to do two things on that content. Block personal data collection.
Right.
And stop serving personalized ads, specifically to safeguard children's privacy.
So it's meant to create a safer zone online for kids.
That's the idea. It's a regulatory safeguard designed to put a kind of digital fence around their sensitive data.
Okay. And this is where Disney's compliance effort... Well, it went wrong, didn't it? It's almost ironic.
How so?
According to the FTC's complaint, Disney intended to be compliant. They marked all videos uploaded to their YouTube channels at the channel level as made for kids.
Okay, that sounds comprehensive. Like they were trying to cover everything.
On the surface, yeah. It sounds like a proactive measure, right? You'd assume designating the entire channel as MFK would ensure broad protection for all the videos within it.
Seems logical.
But here's the surprising, almost counterintuitive consequence. YouTube's internal systems, when they processed this channel-level designation, well, they inadvertently led to each individual video being incorrectly tagged as Not Made for Kids, or NMFK.
Wait, what? Marking the whole channel made individual videos not made for kids. How does that work?
It seems like a flaw in how the system interpreted the channel-level setting versus individual video settings. A failure in the handoffs, maybe, between Disney's broad intent and YouTube's granular implementation.
That's unexpected.
Yeah, and YouTube actually noticed this significant discrepancy itself. They alerted Disney back in 2020 that they had switched labels for over 300 Disney videos back from NMFK to MFK.
So YouTube caught it and corrected it, at least for those 300.
For those ones, yes. But think about the period before that, and these weren't obscure minor videos either. We're talking incredibly popular content. Music and visuals from beloved franchises like The Incredibles, Coco, Toy Story, Frozen, even Mickey Mouse himself.
Wow, the biggest names.
Prime content for children that was, for some period, mislabeled and therefore underprotected from data collection.
Okay, so that mislabeling happened. What was the actual harm? What's the intriguing aspect here?
Well, the intriguing aspect, or maybe the worrying aspect, is the ripple effect of that mislabeling.
Go on.
The FTC's complaint states very clearly that this incorrect NMFK tagging allowed Disney, operating through YouTube's infrastructure, to collect personal data from children under 13 who were watching these clearly child-directed videos.
Ah, so the data collection wasn't blocked as it should have been.
Exactly. And this data wasn't just collected and stored idly somewhere. It was then actively used for targeted advertising directed at those children.
That's the core violation, bypassing COPPA's parental consent.
Precisely. And there was also a significant financial incentive involved. Disney received a portion of the ad revenue generated by YouTube from ads placed alongside Disney videos.
Okay.
And they also got revenue from ads that Disney sold directly on that content.
So a direct financial benefit from the mislabeled videos.
It appears so, according to the FTC. Now, beyond the $10 million civil penalty, the settlement also imposes some pretty stringent requirements on Disney going forward.
Like what?
They must now explicitly notify parents before collecting kids' personal information, reinforcing that core COPPA rule.
Enter.
And, crucially, they have to implement a completely new, robust program specifically designed to ensure proper MFK designation for all future YouTube videos.
Trying to prevent this from happening again.
That's the aim, to prevent any recurrence of unlawful data collection. It sends a clear message about accountability, I think.
Definitely.
So, okay, stepping back, what are the practical implications of this for you, for parents, for anyone online? This story isn't just about one company's error or a single regulatory fine, is it?
No, it really illuminates a much larger, more pervasive landscape.
Yeah.
The FTC itself noted, just back in September 2024, that video streaming and social media companies generally are engaged in, well, widespread surveillance of children and teens.
Widespread surveillance.
And broad data sharing. Reportedly, they're earning billions annually just by monetizing kids' and teens' data.
Billions. Billions. Wow.
So this Disney case, while specific, kind of highlights the immense challenge of regulatory enforcement in this really dynamic online environment. Even large, well-resourced brands can inadvertently misapply complex compliance rules.
Or maybe find loopholes.
Well, or it just highlights the inherent conflict of interest, right? When the platforms themselves or the content creators on them are also the ones monetizing children's data.
Right. The incentive is to collect more data.
Potentially, yes. So for your own digital security and privacy, what this means is that even with regulations like COPPA firmly in place, vigilance is absolutely key.
You can't just rely on the rules being followed perfectly.
Unfortunately, no. This incident really prompts us to consider how much data is actually being collected from younger users across the board. And it underscores the immense responsibility of content creators and platforms to get it right.
Yeah.
It's a sobering reminder, I think, that privacy isn't just about hackers and data breaches. It's also about how our data, and especially our children's data, is being used routinely by the very companies we often trust implicitly with our entertainment.
It definitely asks us to be more critical consumers of digital content and services, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Question the defaults, check the settings.
Okay. From those concerns about privacy and data collection, let's pivot now to our third story, and this one. Well, it sounds like it's ripped straight out of a blockbuster movie.
Oh, intriguing.
But it's very much real and deeply unsettling. We're talking about an attempted digital bank heist of truly epic proportion.
A bank heist. Okay.
Hackers recently tried to steal a staggering $130
million. $130
million. Yep. From Cinquia S.A., which is a Brazilian subsidiary of the financial technology giant Evertech.
Okay, a major fintech player. What was the target?
The audacious target was Cinquia's operational environment on Brazil's incredibly popular real-time payment system, known as Pix.
Ah, Pix. That's huge in Brazil.
Exactly. This unauthorized activity, which could have been absolutely catastrophic, was identified on August 29, 2025. It basically threw this major fintech firm into full-blown crisis mode.
I can only imagine.
It's a high-stakes, high-tech, and a really stark reminder of the sophisticated threats lurking on the financial front lines of cybersecurity.
Definitely. And maybe we should place Pix in context a bit more.
Good idea.
As you said, Pix is not just any payment system. It's Brazil's instant payment system, a really monumental initiative launched by the Central Bank of Brazil back in November 2020.
Relatively new then.
Quite new, but incredibly successful. Its key features are its 247 instant fund transfers. That makes it super convenient and, well, ubiquitous now.
Everyone uses it.
Because of its speed, accessibility, and the fact that it has zero-fee transactions for individuals, it has rapidly become the most widely used payment method in Brazil. It processes billions of transactions annually.
Wow. But success breeds attention.
Right? Exactly. One naturally wonders why such a successful system would be targeted. And what's fascinating here, or perhaps predictable, is that despite its efficiency and widespread adoption, Pix is also often targeted by Android banking malware.
Ah, so criminals are already focusing on it.
Yes, making it a particularly high-value target. Its success, unfortunately, makes it a magnet for those looking to exploit digital financial systems on a grand scale. They want to leverage its real-time capabilities for illicit gains.
Okay, so Pix is the target environment.
Yeah.
But how did the hackers actually try to pull off stealing $130 million? What was the entry point?
This is the critical detail, and it's something we see time and time again, a common yet devastating vulnerability. The investigation into the incident revealed that the hackers gained access to Cinquia's Pix environment by using, get this, stolen credentials for an IT vendor's account.
A vendor, not Cinquia itself.
Correct. This is a classic example of a supply chain attack.
Explain that a bit more.
Well, attackers often don't go directly for the main target, especially if its perimeter defenses, its front door, are really robust. Instead, they pivot.
They look for weaker links.
Exactly. They exploit a weakness in a third-party vendor, a supplier, or a service provider that has legitimate, often privileged, access into the primary target's systems.
So the vendor had access to Cinquia's Pix system?
Presumably, yes. And in this case, those stolen vendor credentials were the golden key. They allowed the attackers to bypass Cinquia's direct defenses and walk right into their critical Pix environment.
Wow. That highlights a really sophisticated and, you said, increasingly common attack vector.
Very much so. Stolen credentials for third-party vendors. They're often acquired through highly targeted phishing campaigns directed at the vendor's employees.
Or weak passwords. Lack of MFA.
Or exploiting weak passwords or a lack of multi-factor authentication on the vendor side. The attackers don't need to break into the bank, Cinquia, directly. They just need to compromise someone, the vendor, who already has the keys.
That's scary. So once they were inside...
Once inside Cinquia's Pix environment, the hackers attempted to perform unauthorized business-to-business transactions.
Trying to move the money out.
Exactly. Involving two financial institutions that are customers of Cinquia. Now, initial local media reports implicated HSBC.
A huge name.
Right. But the bank quickly issued a statement clarifying that, thankfully, no customer funds or data were actually impacted.
Okay, that's a relief.
A significant relief. But the sheer audacity of attempting to move $130 million really underscores the severe financial risks posed by these types of supply chain vulnerabilities.
It's a stark illustration, isn't it? How the weakest link in a complex interconnected network can potentially compromise even the strongest institutions.
Absolutely. It's all about that interconnectedness. Now, upon detecting this highly aggressive incident, Cinquia reacted swiftly.
What did they do?
They immediately halted all transaction processing in their Pix environment. Stopped everything.
Makes sense. Damage control.
And they wisely brought in outside cybersecurity forensics experts to investigate the full scope and nature of the breach. Figure out exactly what happened, how, and how far the attackers got.
And the money.
Yeah.
The $130 million.
The encouraging news is that part of the $130 million has already been recovered.
Oh, good.
Although the exact amount wasn't publicly specified, and those recovery efforts are still very much ongoing.
Okay. And did the breach spread beyond Cinquia's PIX system?
Evertech, Cinquia's parent company, has stated that, so far, there's no indication the impact extends beyond that specific PIX environment. And critically, no evidence of personal data exposure either.
Also good news. But there must have been consequences, right? The central bank can't have been happy.
Oh, definitely not. There have been significant regulatory consequences. Cinquia's access to PIX has been temporarily revoked by the Central Bank of Brazil.
Wow, cut off from the system.
It's a clear signal of the severity of the breach and, you know, the absolute importance of maintaining trust in a national payment system like PIX.
So Cinquia is scrambling now.
The company is now actively working, providing all the necessary details and assurances to the central bank, hoping for a quick restoration of their PIX services.
But the damage is done, in a way.
Well, from a strategic standpoint, one naturally wonders, even though funds are being recovered, the financial and reputational impact.
Yeah, the trust factor.
Exactly. And the impact on Evertech's internal controls, their market perception that's not yet fully known and could be material, could be significant.
Especially since they support other banks, right?
Especially since, as you said, Cinquia's PIX environment supports operations for 24 different financial institutions in Brazil. This isn't just an isolated incident affecting one company.
No, it's a potential ripple effect through a big chunk of Brazil's financial ecosystem.
Precisely. And it raises broader questions about third-party risk management, especially in the fast-moving fintech sector.
Okay, so let's bring this home. What does this all mean for you, whether you're, say, a business leader or just managing your own personal finances online?
Well, this story absolutely underscores how profoundly critical third-party security is in our increasingly interconnected world.
It's not just about your own security.
No. If a major fintech firm operating right at the heart of a national payment system can be breached via a vendor's stolen credentials, well, it's a stark reminder for all businesses and even individuals to rigorously scrutinize who has access to their systems and data.
Even indirect access through service providers.
Especially that indirect access. For businesses, this means implementing really robust vendor risk management programs.
Like what?
Demanding evidence of strong security controls from your vendors, maybe adopting zero trust architectures for third-party access.
Zero trust. Meaning,
essentially, don't automatically trust anyone, even if they're inside your network perimeter or are a known partner. Verify explicitly. Ensure that even trusted partners only have the absolute minimal access required for the minimal time needed to do their job. Least privilege.
Got it. Limit the potential damage if they get compromised.
Exactly. And this incident also circles right back to that ever-present human element in cybersecurity.
How so?
Stolen credentials are rarely just found floating around. They are often the result of sophisticated phishing attacks targeting employees.
Clicking the wrong link.
Or employees using weak or reused passwords across multiple sites. Or, critically, a lack of multi-factor authentication, MFA.
MFA again, it keeps coming up.
It's so crucial. This is really a call for continuous security awareness training for employees and the absolute necessity of enforcing MFA for all accounts, especially those with any kind of privileged access, vendor accounts included.
So the ongoing battle continues.
It's a battle that never truly stops. It requires robust security protocols, well-drilled incident response plans, knowing what to do when something does go wrong, and just constant vigilance, especially when you're dealing with high-value targets like payment systems. It requires a proactive, multi-layered defense.
Okay, let's try and put this all into perspective as we wrap up. We've journeyed through a digital landscape today that's, well, as thrilling as it is sobering, I think.
Definitely a mix.
Revealing this really intricate dance between innovation and threat. We began with the absolutely escalating scale of DDoS attacks, orchestrated by clever botnets like RapperBot.
Showing how even unassuming smart devices can be weaponized.
Exactly. Your NVR, your router, becoming part of a digital army. Then we moved to the critical importance of child online privacy, vividly highlighted by Disney's $10 million COPPA violation.
Reminding us of the insidious nature of hidden data collection, even from kids.
Yeah, even in content specifically designed for them. And finally, we explored that sophisticated $130 million financial heist attempt at Cinquia.
Demonstrating the profound vulnerability of even robust systems to supply chain attacks through compromised vendors.
Each of these stories, they provide not just a headline, right?
Mm-hmm.
But a detailed, deeply researched look into the actual threats and the defenses that are shaping our digital world right now.
And what's truly captivating attention here, I think, is how these diverse incidents, they're unique in their specific, sure, but they all point to the same fundamental truth.
Which is?
In an increasingly connected world, every single link in the chain, from that smart device in your home running outdated firmware, mm-hmm. to a third-party vendor providing services to a major financial institution, every link represents a potential point of vulnerability.
No system is isolated anymore.
Pretty much. Understanding these stories, grasping the mechanisms behind them, helps us all better navigate that profound complexity. Hopefully identify risks before they actually materialize. And one significant query that really surfaces from all this is, how do we as individuals, as businesses, as a society, how do we effectively balance the incredible convenience and innovation that technology brings?
Which we all love.
With the absolute necessity for robust security and privacy, especially when the lines between our personal and professional digital lives are just so irrevocably blurred now, and the stakes, as we've seen today, are higher than ever.
That's the big question, isn't it? The balancing act.
It really is.
So for your own journey through the digital world, as you go about your day after listening to this, maybe consider this. In a world where digital attacks can be as quick as a 35-second DDoS tsunami, as insidious as a mislabeled video quietly collecting data from children, or as audacious as a $130 million bank heist attempt, what's one concrete step you can take today?
Just one thing.
Yeah, just one step you can take today to make your own digital footprint a little safer, a little more private, maybe a little more secure. Perhaps it's checking the security settings on those IoT devices we talked about.
Definitely a good start.
Or finally enabling multi-factor authentication on every important account that offers it. Please do that if you haven't.
Yes, please.
Or maybe it's simply being more critically aware of the permissions you grant to apps and online services you sign up for. Even a small step genuinely makes a difference.
Every little bit helps build resilience.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us for another incredibly insightful deep dive here on Cyber Mornings Daily.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
We'll be back soon with more fascinating insights to help you stay informed and secure in our ever-evolving digital landscape. Until next time, stay curious, stay vigilant,
and stay safe out there.